Well, we enter life with nothing and we leave it with nothing. So why bother? The best laid plans come to nothing, so why bother? Wicked people steal and kill, they hate and hurt, they rule and they die without facing justice. Whilst innocent people suffer, die, their lives are cut short, painful lives. Is there any meaning to life when these things happen? Now, some people say that the Bible is not relevant to life in the 21st century. And yet, those kind of questions which are just asked, there's a very full discussion of them in this book that we've got open, Ecclesiastes, as well as in other places. Here's a man, Solomon, who is in quite a unique position to be able to discuss these sorts of things. He lived in a great time of peace and prosperity and wealth. His father before him had established his kingdom, put down enemies, given Solomon great freedom to do whatever he wished to do. And one of the things he did was to make a survey, to make a tour of life and its potential, to search with wisdom, to search what potential there was in wealth, in pleasure, in wine, in women, in all kinds of areas of life, to find his heart's desire to make life work, to get control over life, to make it what it feels like it ought to be. Now, he, in that discussion, heads towards a conclusion. It's very important to keep your eyes on the conclusion. And it's hinted at throughout. It's there really at the beginning as well. The conclusion is to fear God. The conclusion is that life only makes sense when you go beyond an under-the-sun perspective. When you don't just look at what can be seen. When you don't just try to make this world your oyster and get control over it. When you live life with understanding, you live it as in God's presence. You honour God and you look to what's beyond. You trust that all things will one day be put right, though not in this life. He heads towards the conclusion. Now all has been heard. Here is the end of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. So, in a way, in this book, he takes the kind of skeptic on his own terms. And he says, well, let's discuss. If we leave out faith and trust in the living God as we go along, if we see what else we can make of life without him, if we only look under the sun, what can you make of it? Take them on their own terms and see what can be deduced. And he keeps, as he does that, again and again throughout the book, coming back to the point that we need God to make sense of life and to find purpose and meaning in life, to not just see it as endless frustration. Now, he discusses in the way that those of the East did, and I came to understand do, that he tours the subject from a number of angles. He goes round it this way, he goes round it that way. It's not in the style that a lot of our education tends to be done in, and the style I think you find often in the New Testament, in Paul, especially. We tend to do things logically, build step by step, lay foundation, build the next thing on top of it, build the second floor, build the third floor. He does the other style of touring round and round, and maybe littler circles, maybe bigger circles, and you think, I'm sure you said some of those things before. My children say, Dad, you said the same things as you said last time from Ecclesiastes. I say, well, I think God said some of the same things. So
So if God says some of the same things, we've got to say some of the same things, don't we? Because we're just here to say what God says. But each time, of course, there's some variation. He gets another angle on it. So we have to be trying to be alert to that. What do we have then in this chapter? Well, in this part, it's part of an extended discussion of wisdom. What can you do with wisdom? What are the limits of wisdom? What's its value? And in verses 1 to 3, which is the first heading I'm going to take, got what we see. The same events come to all. What we see, the same events come to all. He says, I reflected on all this and concluded. He's weighing up what he's looked at before. What does wisdom say? Well, however wise you are, however righteous you are, your life is in God's hands. It's not in your hands. And the events of your life can be very unpredictable. He says, you cannot, from looking at a person's life and seeing the good things that come to them or the bad things that come to them, say, this one is loved by God and that one is hated by God. This one is approved by God, this one is rejected by God. You cannot say, well, this one is wealthy, his life is peaceful, his plan succeeds, so therefore God favours him. Whereas this one, he's sick, he's troubled, his plans turn to rubble, he's far from God. You cannot do that. Your life is in God's hands, but no man knows whether love or hate awaits him, he says in verse 1. You can't say what's coming next. You find a Job, and he's the most righteous man on the earth. And what's coming next? His business is going to be destroyed in a moment. His house is going to fall down. His children are going to die. His bodily health is going to disintegrate. And why is that happening to him? It's happening to him because he's the most righteous man on the earth at his time. Yet here's a Herod. He's powerful. He plots. He schemes to keep his hold on power. And it seems to work. There's a dynasty of the Herods who pass power on from one to another. Now it all unravels in the end. But if you're there in the middle of that and observing, say, well, how can this be? Here's Herod, he just uses religion as a tool of his politics to get his hands on power, and it seems to work. He plots and schemes, and God's holy people are just pawns in his plan, and it seems to work. How about the Lord Jesus Christ himself? He was rejected, he was mocked, he was beaten, he was scourged. He was crucified, and yet he was God's son, approved of God, uniquely, like no one else. And yet, the general tendency of the world, of course, we wouldn't have the whole book of Proverbs otherwise. The general tendency of the world is that hard work leads to success, whereas laziness leads to pretty much nothing except trouble. That wisdom is able to make a course through troubles, whereas folly just blunders right into them. The world is an orderly place. God has designed it so that if you walk in the creation according to the will of the Creator, then life in it goes well. Whereas if you fight against the Creator, if you fight against the order of his creation, then life becomes twisted and tangled and troubled. So, how to make sense of all of this? Well, Solomon sees value in wisdom, but it's not an unlimited value. It's not an omnipotent power. By being righteous, you don't get yourself out of God's hands and into your own hands. No matter how wise or holy you are, you never get to take control of the world.
The wise person actually will realize that would be a terrible idea. You never get control of the world, you never come out of God's hand. You're always in the hand of the one who is infinitely wise and the one who always knows what's best for you. That's what Solomon's seeing in these first few verses. But what is meditation particularly turned to in verses 2 and 3 is the sameness of the events that come to the righteous and the wicked. He said all share a common destiny. In particular, he's thinking of the grave. Doesn't matter, he says, if you're righteous or wicked, good or bad, clean or unclean, whether you offer sacrifice, whether you don't offer sacrifice, whether you're a good man, whether you're a wicked man, whether you make oaths, or whether you fear to take them, whether you're careful with the words that come from your lips, or whether you're careless. The same destiny comes to all. He says, all die. So wisdom and righteousness can never be a tool for gaining ultimate control, can they? And they never have. There's an infallible rule. One out of every one dies. Someone's going to put his hand up and say, well, Elijah was taken up to heaven in the chariot, all right. But if we leave out Enoch and Elijah, one out of everyone who's entered this world has died. And no amount of righteousness or wisdom can ever take that reality away. That's a repeated theme in the book. He says, like the fool, the wise man must also die. He says, there's a time to live and a time to die. He says, naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour, he can carry nothing in his hand. He says, do not all go to the same place. And evil takes strength from that observation. That's in verse 3. And wicked people observe that no matter what happens to you, you seem to go the same way and the same events seem to come. So why not just follow your desires? Grab what you want. Trample over other people to get there. Live greedily. Live selfishly. Live as if it makes no difference. Because if you just look with these outward eyes, it seems to make no difference. And so men give free rein to the evil that's in their hearts. The hearts of men, moreover, are full of evil. There is madness in their hearts while they live. Afterwards, they join the dead. People say, well, all that will happen is that we'll die, and that's going to happen to us anyway. There's no justice in this life. As the Allied forces closed in on Berlin, and as Hitler saw the prospect of justice coming, he ended his life by killing himself, taking the destiny which all face anyway, avoiding being called to account in any courts which might be set up anywhere in this world. And that's the way it has been, and that's the way it will always be. There is no utopia. There will always be evil. Nazism was the great threat to world peace. Then communism was the great threat to world peace. A militant Islam is the great threat to world peace. One falls, another rises. If this life is your only hope, then it's bleak, isn't it? If this life is all that there is, then you might be tempted to say, well, I just grab what I can get and forget everybody else. Because who else is going to look after number one if number one doesn't? If this life is your only hope, then it's a life that you can't control and where evil people do whatever they like. What a terrible position to be in. And yet, Solomon's point is that this life is not all.
If you do invest your hopes in being able to control this life and in being able to build your little paradise on earth, then there is no hope. But the Christian is in a different position. And we get onto that more as we come into verses 4 to 10. That's how we respond. Embracing life every day. You see, the cynic can say, well, there's no point. Evil will keep springing up in the world. Evil is all around us. The world will always be full of it. We can't control it, as you've observed, that the righteous and the wicked all face all the calamities of life. You can't predict what's coming next. So, there's no point. Just give up. Life is meaningless. Despair. Despair and die. But no, says Solomon. He draws quite a different conclusion. Verse 4 says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. There's hope because you're alive. Yes, we live with the knowledge of being mortal. We live knowing that life shall end. But we live knowing. The dead, he says, know nothing at all. And from perspective of this world, this creation, the centre of God's purposes for the universe, when you're gone, you're gone. All the things that you can experience in God's creation are experienced in this time, in the today, in the now. Now, he's not denying that there is a life beyond this one, but he's taking that under the sun perspective, this theatre where God is working out his purposes, this life before we go to the judgment. It's lived now and it's lived only once. There's no blessings of this world to be experienced at all by those who have left it. Their love, their hate, their jealousy have long since vanished. Never again will they have a part in anything that happens under the sun. Remember, he's taking a particular perspective there. He's not giving a theological treatment of what happens after death. He's investigating what you can say about how to live this life. So lion is a mighty beast, the king of the jungle, majestic, not to be compared with a dog. As in those days especially, they didn't keep dogs for pets, and they hadn't bred them so that you get some very beautiful and very interesting breeds once they've been carefully bred for a number of generations. It was more like what we used to see in Africa, that the dogs were the strays. They were running around the streets, they were scavenging, they were all mongrels. There was nothing particularly attractive about any of them. Often skinny scavengers. But the skinny scavenger that's alive has something very precious that a lion doesn't. If that lion is dead, it has life. And so it comes to verse 7. It says, eat your food with gladness. That's translated bread in most versions. Drink your wine with a joyful heart. For it is now that God favours what you do. Where can we find joy? If we can't predict the future, if you don't know if your business will tomorrow collapse, if you don't know if tragedy will come in your family next week, if you don't know when your life will end, where then can the believer find joy? The Bible says actually it's all around you. You're making contact with it, you're feeling it, you're walking through it all the time. You live in a world in which God has made life colourful and tasteful, which God has placed the sound of birds, which there's music for your ears. But God has placed you in relationships and communities. God gives you food on your plate, clothes on your back. It's all around you. These are God's good gifts. Had a little
discussion just a little one not very long in our household, because last year for Christmas we had some Christmas presents and some activities, some clubs to do each week that we do through the year. So some of my children have been to certain clubs the whole year, and when the discussion came up, will those happen again next year, or do we just think that because we got them last year they're now here forever? And now we think, what else can we get this year? We'll add something new on top, because now we have those, we always go to those clubs, and now we'll add in some more ones. And isn't that the way that we often think, that with all the things we've got, well, they're just normal, they're boring, they're part of the scenery, we expect those, we have a right to those. Those things are all ours. What else can I get? That's how human beings treat life. We've got God's goodness flowing all around us in so many things, and yet thinking, well, that's dull. What I want is my mansion, my empire. I want to get my name up in the lights. What I want is to boost my bank balance. And all the gifts of God's goodness, which he gave us yesterday, he gives us today, he's given us every day since we've been born, we just ignore those and they float past us and we think they're very little things. Yet God gives us these great blessings day by day. So he says, go eat your food with gladness, drink your wine with a joyful heart. The everyday blessings of life. Verse 9, enjoy life with your wife, whom you love. Verse 8, always be clothed in white. Always anoint your head with oil. So don't go around as a mourner because of the shadow that death casts over life. And the time will come when there's mourning over the end of your life. But that time hasn't come yet. God's given you today. Don't fret because you don't know whether he'll give you tomorrow. Embrace the fact that he has given you today. Don't be a mourner because of grief that hasn't yet come. God gives good gifts. Receive them. Rejoice in them. Don't say, oh, I've had that one before, and throw it out in the rubbish. Now that's not head in the sand thinking, says Solomon. That's not the ostrich who doesn't want to look at what's around him. Yes, verse 9. Do this all the days of your vain life that God has given you under the sun. All your vain days. Yes, your life is full, verse 9, of toilsome labour under the sun. It is full of much trouble. Many things you have to do over and over just to stand in the same position. All that is there. All that is known. But all of that is not the whole picture. And the way to live life is not to let that dominate. We live in a fallen world. We live in a broken world. Toilsome labour has been a fact of it ever since Adam was ejected from the garden, made to make his food, grow his fruit through the sweat of his brow, having to dig up all the thorns and thistles that the ground produced when he was trying to get a harvest. Yes, all that is there. But God would not have us to utterly focus on that. We're not meant to live life like Eeyore and only see the gloomy side. We're meant to see that God's gifts still remain and to embrace them as the gifts which they are. Now a Christian can do this, because a true Christian who has the Spirit of God living in them, a true Christian who's been converted to Jesus Christ, understands ultimately he's living in an in-between time. See, the unbeliever, when he sees the outcome and when he sees the trouble and when he sees that whatever plans he laid may fall down right at the crucial point when he thought they were all going to finally succeed, He can only despair, can't he? What can he ultimately hope for? Whatever he gets will soon be somebody else's. But a Christian knows he's living in an in-between time. We know the world is fallen and not as it should be. Yet the Creator is still active in his creation, still giving us good gifts along each step of the way. Listen, there is little justice in this life. But we know that there is a life to come. We know there's a new world which he's bringing in.
We know that Jesus has shed his blood to redeem this world and to make it new. We know that the future will be glorious. So if you're on the march, on a journey, that journey may be long. It may be painful. You may get lots of blisters. Your pack that you're carrying might be very heavy. The places where you get to pitch your tent each night, they may lack a great deal. They may be far, far from the warm, comfortable bed you like to sleep in. But if you know where the destination is that you're getting to, and if you've got provisions to warm your heart along the way, one day's worth of provisions at a time, then you can keep going, can't you? You can keep travelling. If you know that in your pack there's warm soup and fresh bread today, and you can smile as you put your head down to sleep, you can get up in the morning with another smile as you go on, because you're living in the in-between. You know it's not forever. So you can live, as he says in verse 4, with hope. We can look to the future with hope. Now, these things are much clearer to us now. We think of Paul saying in Philippians that he'd learned the secret of being content in every situation in life. That he knew, Philippians 4 verse 11, he knew how to be in need and how to have plenty. He learned the secret of every situation of being content, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or living in want. I can do everything, he said, through Christ who gives me strength. With the gospel sustaining him, with the promises of the future sustaining him, can keep going. So, in a similar way, verse 10, since God is ruling, since our times are ultimately in his hands, does that mean we just become fatalists? We do nothing, we attempt nothing, we say, well, it's all in God's hands anyway. If I work very hard at this venture, it might come to nothing, so why bother? No, we say, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. For in the grave where you're going, there's no work, there's no planning, there's no knowledge, there's no wisdom. Whatever you're going to do, you have to do it in this life. You have to do it now. Do you wish to be someone who reads the scriptures and knows what God says? Well, you have to do that now, because you won't be able to do it when you're dead. Do you have it in your heart and mind that you want to be someone who prays, who grows to a deeper knowledge of God and intimacy with him through prayer? Well, you have to do that now. You have to do that in this life. You won't be able to do it in the grave. Do you want to be someone who's a witness to those around them, who lives with courage as a Christian, not cowed by the spirit of the age and all the things we're meant to do and say and believe, but someone who openly lives for God? Well, you have to do that now. You have to do it today. You can't do it in the grave when you're dead. You want to be someone who makes a difference to this world for God's sake and in God's name. But you can't do that when you're dead. You have to do it now. You have to do it today. So whatever is in front of you, whatever task Providence has given you, do it with all your might, all your strength. Now is the time to serve Christ. The fact of death does not lead us to despair and fatalism. It leads us to energetic service, because this is our opportunity for it. So I'm going to have to cover the last verses very swiftly, because we're almost out of time. Verses 11 to 18. It's the value of wisdom. Wisdom helps. It's a benefit, but not an unlimited one. Now he's touring around again. He says, I once saw a city. It was small. There were few to defend it. A great king laid a mighty siege against it. The outcome surely is certain. The city can't stand. But in the city there's a wise man. He's a poor man, but he's wise. By some device he manages to win the battle, and the king goes away empty-handed. Such things have happened. Maybe you heard of the famous story of the defense of the city of Syracuse by Archimedes, that the Roman fleet came against his city. The overwhelming, powerful force of the Roman army. Archimedes, through his wisdom, devised glasses to divert the rays of the sun. By them he burnt the Roman ships. He also devised mighty machines, far, far beyond the technology which the Romans knew, which he used to destroy those coming against the city too. And yet, Solomon says, verse 15, the poor wise man was forgotten. He didn't get the praise or the honour that he deserved for his wisdom. Yes, verse 16, wisdom is better than strength. It can overcome it. But don't expect to be recognised or remembered for it. And verse 18, one sinner destroys much good. Wisdom is a great thing. But you only need, as he goes on in chapter 10, this is where we get the phrase from, you only need one fly in the ointment to make the ointment stink and make you think, I'm not going to put that on me. I'm going to throw it out. One fly in the ointment spoils all the work of the perfumer in preparing it. Archimedes was slain by a Roman soldier much later on, who just took needless offence to something Archimedes said. And instead of Archimedes' gifts and talents being used to help the Romans after they had conquered another time, or being helped to benefit the human race, he was just killed as if he was a nobody in a fit of temper. And that was the end of anything that the world might have learned from Archimedes. Wisdom is a great blessing, is a great benefit, but not an all-powerful one. No such thing exists. Verse 11, however fast you might be, you can trip and not win the race. No matter how strong you might be, the other side might have a better strategy and defeat you. No matter how wise you are, unforeseen events, recession comes, your business collapses, and you haven't got enough food to eat. No matter how brilliant you are, your strategy hits upon something that you could never have foreseen, and you remain a poor man, etc., etc. Time and chance happen to all. I think the greatest example of what we see in verse 12 to 18 and the thought to leave with is if we come to Christ. I read in one commentary and it said, there's something along these lines. It said, if someone were to take the small city as being the church and the mighty king who's come to perceive it as being the devil and the poor wise man who saves it as Christ, then that would be a terrible abuse of the text. And I thought, I think that's actually rather good. I think I'll actually take that because I think we couldn't get a better example of it. Think of the life of Christ. He came to overcome the mighty forces of evil. Yeah, he's despised. He's not listened to by the rulers of the people of God. They reject him. They even take the initiative in having him put to death. And there seems to be Satan's utter triumph. But yet there actually was the wisdom of God, that through Christ dying, all sin could at last be dealt with. The wrath of God could there fall upon him. The power of Satan to hold men could be broken. Sin being paid for, Christ could rise again, rise to God's right hand. There he is, there he rules the world. Though there seemed to be no justice, yet we know one day he will appear as the great king, to bring all justice. All his friends and his enemies will appear before him. He will bring in that new creation. He will punish all wickedness. He will welcome into his presence all those who've repented and trusted in him, their sins being washed away by his blood. Yes, That poor man's wisdom, the wisdom of the gospel, is now despised. And people in our country and all over the world work very hard to try and forget it, to blot it out, to see it and hear it no more. Wasn't there some commission just this week, we read in the news, and published its report saying that we need to systematically scrub out any remains of Christianity from our public life. The benefits which the Bible and the Christian faith have brought to our country are all to be forgotten and got rid of. And yet, verse 17, the quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. The gospel of Christ, the still small voice which tells you to repent and give your life to him, is much more to be listened to than the spirit of the age. Our civilization, like others, come to nothing and will be judged by Christ. But his kingdom will never pass away. So trust your times into God's hands. Enjoy the blessings he gives you day by day. Work with all your might at whatever's in front of you. And wait for the day when the quiet words of the wise are seen to have been of more value than all the shouting of all the fools of this world.